pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. We're up to episode 61. With me is Scott. The Velvet Glove is a little bit worse for wear. Scott, I normally say, how are you? But I'm fully aware you're actually not that good.
I'm okay, thanks, Trevor. It was just I had a little battle with gravity on my bicycle on Sunday a week ago. So yep. Been in the hospital, had an operation, and it's recovering nicely. But I'm off the bike for 6 weeks or thereabouts.
I'm sure the listeners everywhere are wishing you a speedy recovery and are thankful that it wasn't your podcasting arm that was injured, Scott.
No, it was my right arm, but I could still use the fluoro highlighter pen, so it was fine.
So in your absence, we last week had the 12th man, and He was quite happy for the plebiscite to be canned and for everything to be delayed. And I think you've got a different opinion.
I do have a different opinion, Fist, and not to rag on the 12th man or anything like that. But I think that I'm with you. I think the simplest and easiest way forward is for it to be a conscience vote on both sides of Parliament. And get the bloody thing moved forward and moved on with. However, if we can't get there, and it appears the right wing of the Liberal Party has backed Turnbull into a corner on this, if we can't get there, then I think that a plebiscite is the next best option. I think that, there's a couple of things to say about a plebiscite. One is that it will send the religious right packing once and for all. When those numbers are confirmed that there's 65-70% of the population in favour of marriage equality, that will then shut it down once and for all. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's voted on in the Parliament, then they could argue that, oh, well, this isn't the majority of the opinion, that sort of stuff. But if it's a vote that's reflected in the community, I think that will shut them down once and for all. And the other thing, the opponents of the plebiscite are right. It is expensive. $160 million on what is effectively an opinion poll.
Scott, it's a mere periscope in the scheme of things.
Yeah, it is a mere periscope when it comes down to submarines, but $160 million—it is a lot of money, and I'm of the opinion that the money could be better or could be better spent elsewhere in the budget. However, if we can't get to a conscience vote this time round, I think we are better off having a plebiscite and dealing with it once and for all.
See, you had previously, very early on, said what a nasty discussion it's going to lead to. And
It will lead to a nasty discussion.
And I agreed with you that, we don't want a nasty discussion, if at all possible. But I'm actually turned around to the view that I want a nasty discussion because I want the opposing forces to be exposed for who and what they are. And as painful as it might be for the LGBTIQ community, if it exposes these people even more out in the open, and this is one of the arguments for free speech is that I want to know when people are being awful and unreasonable. And and this will actually, I think, in the long run, in the long game, be a good thing for the forces of rational thinking if there's a plebiscite with a full debate with lots of ugly talk, because it'll just turn more and more people against religions, who are the ones, let's face it, who are running this argument.
Exactly. And that is the while you don't want the nastiness that's going to accompany the debate, I think that the nastiness is inevitable, and I think we are better off having it out in the open so that people can see religion for exactly what it is.
Yep, because they are the ones leading this whole charge.
Exactly. And then we can bury this nonsense once and for all that the Australian Christian lobby are just well-meaning and that sort of stuff. We can expose them for the... not hypocrites, but barefaced pig dog animal bastards that they are.
Well, for the unchristian Christians that they are, perhaps. Anyway, yeah, Scott, last week I mentioned that there was a talk going on at a church near me, and I couldn't make it. And but one of our members listening to the podcast was actually, on the spur of the moment, decided to go. And
Really?
Yeah, sent me an email and, you know, was there for the whole talk by Dr. David Van Gend. And
yes, he was on the Facebook page today from the Secular Party.
So he's a charming fellow who's associated with the Knights of the Southern Cross. And anyway, this member, who asked to remain anonymous, just reported on it that he went to the meeting with his wife, and he said it was appalling and terrifying at the same time. His wife was trembling with anger and fear. He said, "I had some challenging questions prepared, but I was too scared to ask them." This is the tone of the meeting in the church.
Doesn't that say a lot? He's too scared to ask the questions.
About 80 people present, even though the Knights of the Southern Cross organised it, they were deferring to the ACL people who were present. David Van Gend declared that the ACL and Lyle Shelton are the organising group to oppose same-sex marriage, with lots of different organisations under them. And he said he could not divulge the name of the organisations, as there may be spies in the audience. They want 750 volunteers in every electorate in Australia to distribute flyers, door knock, man polling booths, etc. One of the declared ACL people closely supervised the handing around of a list for people to sign up as volunteers to the cause. Basically stood at the end of each row and carefully watched each person sign. So our deep throat at the meeting, Scott, estimated that 70 of the 80 people signed up.
Really? Yeah, okay.
And it goes on, a very threatening and nasty feel to it if you were just an ordinary person attending to find out what was going on. So, the more... More of that.
In our deep
hear.
Throat didn't volunteer to.
No, he didn't. He was one of the 10 out of the 80 who didn't. And when the meeting concluded, quickly scurried into his car and got out of there. So,
yeah.
So that was that.
Isn't it incredible.
Okay. Other news. Scott, Mother Teresa. You know, she's no Mother Teresa, is she?
I mean, one of my first introductions to Christopher Hitchens was after he died. I looked him up online and that sort of stuff, and I watched an expose that he made about Mother Teresa. She is a cruel megalomaniac. She got off on watching people suffer. She didn't try and alleviate the pain of the people or anything like that. She just gave them a place to die. You know, she's not some miracle worker or anything else. And yet the whole world, it seems, fell over itself to kiss up to her.
Yes.
You know, it was a disgusting period of time. And when you look back on it, you know, with open eyes, you can tell that she wasn't a very nice person.
Before I talk about the article that we've got a link to, Scott, So I've got a few things of surprises here. You're getting this the same time as the listener, but
right.
The same member who attended the church to listen to the Knights of the Southern Cross sent me another message, and I think now we're going to have to call that member just Deep Throat is the nickname.
Deep Throat, no worries.
I'll tell you who he or she is afterwards.
Yeah, no worries.
So in future podcasts, when we talk about Deep Throat, we're talking about the same member who's made these two contributions.
If Deep Throat ever comes on, we'll have to disguise his voice or something like that.
That's right. We will. So Deep Throat sent me another message, and he said, "Hi, Trevor. It is my week to be angry with the Catholics. It beggars belief that the Vatican would make Mother Teresa a saint. She should have faced a jail sentence. When I was working in a small hospital in India in 1983-84, we managed many cases of life-threatening meningococcal septicemia, or it might be meningococcus septicemia. This was due to several epidemics of the disease over those 2 years that swept through the town and the boarding school at the time. I well remember the fear that enveloped that boarding school. The students were terrified that they would be next. The doctors of the hospital developed great skill in the management of this disease. One of our doctors, a brilliant doctor who is now a professor, decided to go to Calcutta to work with Mother Teresa. Our doctor was soon back because of her disgust at the treatment of those in Teresa's care. Mother Teresa chose to treat children with the meningococcal infection with love rather than penicillin. Penicillin at the time was dirt cheap in India. Neglect of this magnitude is a heinous crime." Signed, Deep Throat.
That doesn't surprise me that you hear that. It's it's bloody disgraceful, really, when you actually say it out loud, isn't it?
Well, the apologists would say she did the best with the resources that she had, and at least
and
she was doing something.
That is garbage, you know. Yep. It talks about in here somewhere.
Well, a waste of she acquired all this money, but then didn't use any of it for it for actually helping people. But something like penicillin, people could have gone somewhere to get penicillin and survived, and instead they went to her, and she prayed over them as they suffered their death.
They suffered and died. Yeah.
Mm. So. So that's Mother Teresa. So this article I've got a link to says, I think she was canonised on September the 4th, just a couple of days ago. This one talks about the two miracles that are required for being canonised a saint. So apparently if you're going to be beatified, you need one, and then if you're going to be canonised as a saint, you need an extra one to get two.
Mm.
And what this article says, I talked about Christopher Hitchens. So you mentioned him and his documentary. So when somebody's going to be, when they're, open inverted commas, investigating whether somebody should be a saint, there's like a devil's advocate role of somebody who says, no, they shouldn't be. And Christopher Hitchens actually had that role. The official devil's advocate role for the Mother Teresa sainthood program. Unfortunately, he wasn't successful. The first miracle, the one that was required for her beatification, was a case of an Indian tribal woman, Monica Basra, who claimed to have been cured in 1998 of stomach cancer in the form of tubercular tumour after she placed a locket with a picture of Mother Teresa on her abdomen. However, the doctors who treated the then 30-year-old woman stated she'd actually been cured with 9 months of anti-tubercular medication. Reporting to the West Bengal government, the doctors insisted that Mrs. Basra had continued to receive medical treatment long after the death of Mother Teresa. Basra's husband, Sekou Mermu, agrees, quote, "It is much ado about nothing. My wife was cured by the doctors and not by any miracle," end quote. He adds, "My wife did feel less pain one night when she used the locket, but her pain had been coming and going. Then she went to the doctors and they cured her.
Yeah.
This exactly. sort of nonsense. And the second miracle attributed to Mother Teresa was cloaked in secrecy. Reportedly, a Brazilian man's life was saved after his priest prayed for Mother Teresa to intervene with God. However, the man's identity was not disclosed at the time in order to maintain the discretion needed for the investigation. I mean, how can they keep a straight face when this with this stuff? The gall. Well,
it was, you know, the whole article was banked, you know. It summed it up beautifully at the end of it all, where it said, "The church's approach is obviously an attempt to trump science, downplaying its role in many actual cures, choosing remarkable cases to emphasise their medically inexplicable nature. Doctors, including Catholic doctors, should refuse to play the miracle game. If the church wishes to honour a doctrinaire nun, let it do so without an affront to science and reason."
Yeah.
You know, never a truer word's been spoken. But it is incredible. I think you described it as an affront. It was an affront because, you know, they grabbed these two people. You know, the first one was incredible. You know, she'd been on 9 months beginning the tubercular treatment.
Yep.
Yeah, and she'd been getting that for 9 months and she was cured.
Mm.
I mean, one would have thought that you'd sit there and say, well, hang on a minute, what worked, the drugs or the praying?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, this whole notion that praying to a certain person makes them the, you know, generator of the miracle is just... Whoever dreamt that one up was just... was in the business of creating saints, weren't they? I mean, when you develop a rule like that, you can go to town on sainthood, then anything's exactly. possible. I mean, that's the one where, you know, you don't really need people present at all. So, anyway, that's Mother Teresa. Scott, last week I mentioned that we were sitting on 99 likes, and wouldn't it be great if we could get to 100? Do you remember? Did you hear that at all? Did you listen to the podcast last week?
No, I did listen to the podcast. Yeah absolutely.
No, so there's good news and there's bad news, Scott.
Good news is we got up, but we also went back.
Well the good news is that we're no longer on 99, dear listener. The bad news is we're on 98. What are you doing to me out there, podcast world? Like, Scott and I and the 12th man with contributions from Deep Throat are working our butts off here, and we've actually dropped from 99 to 98. I mean...
I think it was probably that guy that gave us the review on iTunes that said, you know, don't listen to it, because you know, every time they listen to it, that God kills an angel.
He would not have abandoned us. That fellow's a champ. Oh, lady is a champion. So anyway, dear listener, you know, if you've got any sense of mercy in you, just get us over the line for the 100. I'll shut up about it. Scott, the Andrews government is just in Victoria.
They are really good government, aren't they?
They're just showing how it's done. You get some power, well, you run some bills through Parliament and you make some changes and pass some laws. Like, that's what exactly. you do. If you're listening, Palaszczuk government in Queensland, that's what you do. You know, all those years that you weren't in power when Joe was in power and you wished you could be in power so you could do things, and now here you are, you know, 40 years later and you're doing absolutely nothing. Well, look just down the road at the Andrews government. And so they've anyway introduced a bill which was to the effect that religious schools and bodies could soon find it harder to discriminate against employees because of their sexuality or faith. They've revamped the Victorian Equal Opportunity Laws, and their revamp has been condemned as anti-religious by faith-based groups who say it threatens their right to freedom of religion.
You know, as soon as I read that, I thought to myself, this is the United States all over again.
Mm.
You know, they've got RFRA and that sort of stuff coming through, and they've got that in relation to this sort of stuff.
What this Act is seeking to do is to say that non-teaching roles such as gardeners and administrative people and librarians can be atheist, transgender, gay, whatever. It doesn't matter to the religious school for those people. So that's not much to ask, you know, Christian schools out there, but they are up in arms about it as a threat to their rights to freedom of religion. Scott, I think if you hear the words right to freedom of religion, you just replace it with selfish desire to enjoy special religious privilege and see whether it still works. Later on here, Christian Schools Australia. Well, there's another group, Scott. We've got a Secular Schools Australia.
Yeah, that'll do. Yep.
Australia, you can be president if you like. I'm going to be the Episcopal vicar.
No worries.
So, Christian Schools Australia, Chief Executive, Stephen O'Doherty, said the proposed laws were a draconian attack on religious freedom principles. Okay, let's see.
A load of garbage.
How about a draconian attack on selfish desire to enjoy special religious privilege? Yeah, that works. Yeah,
it works, yeah.
He goes on to say, we feel that the Andrews government is the most anti-religious government we have seen in a long time. Well, there's a reference. So that's the Andrews government. Good on you. Hope the bill gets through. Apparently, Scott, that was a bill there was a Labor government which introduced that same sort of law, and then before it could come into effect, a coalition government came in 2011 and scrapped it. So now the Andrews government is basically resurrecting something that an earlier Labor government had done. So, well done.
Well done to them, you know, top marks to them, that sort of stuff. It really is long overdue. You know, and it's not like it's impacting their religious freedom, because, you know, you've got teachers and that sort of stuff are exempt. You know,
yes.
It's only gardeners and that sort of stuff. So it really is nonsense to suggest that it is attacking religious freedom.
Well, Scott, if there was a poll today, what do you think the election, how would it fall, two-party preferred?
Federally? Okay, probably 51 Labor, 49 Liberal.
The latest Essential report says 52-48. So it's ever since the election, it's been slightly in favour of Labor. And also, Scott, do you expect the coalition government will run its full term until 2019 when the next federal election is due, or do you think there will be an early election? And we do have some beers on this one, don't we, I think?
We don't have beers on this one yet, but I'm beginning to think that it's probably going to go early. You know, especially in light of what happened on Friday night.
Yes.
It is on Thursday night, rather. It is looking pretty awful down there.
Only 35% think it'll run the full term. So
is that right? Yeah.
We better get cracking in the secular party and get some money and memberships going, because we could be back at the polls very soon.
Yeah, it looks that way, doesn't it? Yeah.
Very soon. Have you heard of the word polemic? P-O-L-E-M-I-C.
No, I haven't actually. Couldn't tell you what it means.
Polemic. A strong verbal or written attack on someone or something. For example, his polemic against the cultural relativism of the 60s. Or, I think you could say, this podcast is our polemic against religious privilege. Strong verbal or written attack on someone or something. A polemic. You need that because just the next article uses the word. So, and I'm kind of, it's one of my things I've decided in this podcast is a little bit of vocabulary work. So
you're going to take it highbrow, are you?
Yeah. Yes, at least when we're going to show respect for the English language wherever possible. Okay. This one is called Militant Islam Threatens Liberty. And in this article, the author, Dr. Paul Monk, M-O-N-K, talked about how in a previous sort of article, he had said, we need to keep clearly in mind the distinctions between race and religion, religion and fanaticism. Islam is a religion. It has nothing to do with race. The problem we have is with fanatical Muslims on religious grounds. That problem has to be dealt with in those terms. So he's being very specific, defining religion as opposed to race.
Exactly,
but
yeah.
Makes a statement like that, but doesn't help him at all. Didn't save him from abuse from various regressive leftists. The foreign editor of The Age, Maher Mughrabi, said that the distinctions he made were a lot of nonsense and that, of course, criticism of Islam is racist. And a lecturer in critical thinking at the University of Sydney denounced him on Twitter as a highbrow version of neo-Nazi racists, a photo of whom accompanied his text. Now, what's that law?
Godwin's law.
Godwin's law. There we go. So that was that in operation. So, you can be very distinct in your language and yet people come out and attack you anyway, Scott. There's no hope. You've just got to be prepared to wear the tag racist and...
Yeah, but see, I find that incredible. I mean, he's laid it out there. He said that it's very clear that religion is not a race.
Mm.
And he said that, you know, you can attack religion and that these idiots have then come back in and said, no, of course it's racism.
Mm.
You know, it's not racism.
Mm.
It is crazy that you've got a group of people that say that it is racist. When you've got people from from Bosnia and Herzegovina.
It's a set of ideas which you can...
It is a set of ideas, exactly.
You know, you can take up or reject. It might be more difficult for some than others because there's whole cultural ties attached to it, but they are just ideas at the end of the day.
Exactly, yeah.
Later on in the article, he has this talk about religions are a private matter and must not be practiced or propagated in such a way as just to disturb the common peace. Goes on about that. But, you know, you really, you know, if you're in a debate or, a Q&A or something like that, you'd nearly have to start off with, you know, a statement of, you know, get it out and call me racist now and get it out of your system because you're going to at some stage, so you may as well lead with it and we'll deal with it and then move on because it's just the...
Exactly.
It's the elephant in the room or the prayer mat in the room. Yeah,
it is the prayer mat in the room that you've got this ridiculous situation that a bloke has actually laid it out there, said that it's nothing to do with race, and yet two people who should be eminently sensible,
yes,
you know, a lecturer in critical thinking at the University of Sydney and The Age foreign editor,
yep,
you know, and they both attacked him for being racist. It's garbage. It really is garbage.
I think there must be something about being a foreign editor, because that Craig Sheridan is foreign editor of The Australian, and he was the one who made the comment about, you know, the glorious, you know, wings of the eagle of the US of A are soaring over the Middle East and, you know, all is well with the world. You know, I think there's something about being a foreign editor of a major newspaper that makes you go bonkers at times. Just warn me of that if I ever become foreign editor of, you know, a major newspaper, Scott.
Well, I think Greg Sheridan's in a class of his own, though.
Yeah. Scott, birth control we have mentioned a few times. This article that I've linked to says there are currently... Well, dear listener, before I say... Scott, you've ruined it for me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I want some active listening from the audience at times, Scott. But anyway, dear listener, yes, 7.4 billion people on Earth. By 2100, there could be as many as, well, in this article, it says 12.3 billion. I did a quick search, and the United Nations reckons 11.2 is their figure. That's still a lot. when we're currently on 7.4,
yeah,
and we could easily get to 11, 12, and that's like the middle figures, because there's people, you know, higher and lower with estimations. Oh, that's a lot of people, Scott.
That's a hell of a lot of people, and most of them are going to come from the third world too.
Yes, a lot from Africa when you look at it. So what this article says is the first step would be providing universal and always available contraceptives to people, especially women. Right now, 800 million women who want contraceptives cannot get them. In developing countries, the rate of women deprived of contraceptives can be as high as 60%. And you've got to remember that the developing world, between 2011 and 2012, the developing world, as opposed to the developed world, accounted for 97% of global population growth. So that's what you're saying. It's all coming from underdeveloped countries.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, to get contraceptives in the hands of those people who can't get them at the moment, 8.1 billion annually, Scott. A bargain.
It is an absolute bargain. It really is. It really is an absolute bargain. You know,
Submarines.
Two submarines. Exactly. Now, you know, you've got to. You'd have to accompany that along with the changes to age pensions and that sort of stuff in those countries, because they do have a very large brood to look after them in old age.
Yes.
So you've got. Sorry.
That's true, because you're saying that the young ones support the older grandparents.
Exactly. Yeah. So what you need to do is you need to have an age pension system set up and that sort of stuff at the same time. So $8.1 billion is just that's the lead indicator. But if you've got women in particular able to choose the time at which they fall pregnant, then you end up with a situation that you've got women in charge of their own lives, and they start to save money, they start to delay having children and that sort of stuff, they start investing in their own career and so on and so forth. It really is the best thing any country can do is make it freely and available to everyone, regardless of what your religious doctrine says. Have it available and get it out there in the public as quickly as we possibly can.
The best foreign aid program Australia could be involved with would be a program that concentrated on that. That would be
money
really, really well spent. But while the Catholic Church and the Vatican, no less, has its place on the UN and is meddling in world affairs to the detriment of everybody, it's just going to be incredibly hard to get through. So,
well, it was like that article that we spoke about a couple of months ago now that did mention that. They did mention that there were a couple of bodies that the Vatican were represented on in the United Nations that had been told, no, they're not going to provide contraception.
Yep.
You know, and you're not even talking abortion. You're talking about contraception.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy that they've got this head-in-the-sand approach to it all.
Yep. So so that's that one. We have, like everybody else, railed against multinational companies shifting their profits offshore so that they don't pay tax here. And, Apple hadn't paid any tax here at one stage. It's despicable. So,
it is
anyway,
disgusting.
There's an article where... what Apple has done is it's popped its head office in Ireland, and it's done a special deal with the Irish government where it pays a ridiculously low level of tax. At one stage, it was down to 1%, and in 2014, their effective tax rate in Ireland, where they'd shifted all their money to, was 0.005%. And what's happened is that the European Commission has come down with a ruling saying that Apple has been given illegal tax benefits from Ireland, And the European Commission has said to Ireland, you must recover the unpaid tax that Apple should have paid. And Ireland is saying that they don't want to do it.
Exactly. Ireland has come out and said that they're going to appeal the decision.
Yeah. So a court, a European Commission has said, Ireland, you can have $13 billion. Yeah, 13 billion euro from Apple that you're entitled to, and the Irish government said, we don't want it.
Exactly. It's madness.
This is just... The world has gone mad. But, of course, they don't want it because they're fearful that Apple and companies like them will pull up stumps and no longer rent out offices in Ireland and have some staff there. And they'll go to, you know, the Cayman Islands or Bermuda or the next, you know, tax-dodging nation on the planet that'll take them. So...
Yeah.
Scott, it's just...
It really takes
so long. Like, these things just go on. I think we should say to somebody like Apple, we're going to charge you a percentage of your turnover, 5 or 10%, and we're going to sock that away until we've worked out what your tax is. And... Because they just get to play with this money and they get to then use it to pay for the fancy lawyers and, you know, they've got more stamina than governments do. So these cases drag out for 12, 13, 14 years. So so I think we should be taking some money and trust from these guys and saying, this is a long, drawn-out saga. You know, if you're going to be shifting your money to Ireland, that's not good enough. We're going to be taxing you here and... Pending all that being decided, you can start putting some money aside for us because we don't know if you're going to have it in 12 years' time when the case is eventually decided.
Exactly.
That's why I'm the iron fist, Scott.
No, it really has gone beyond a joke now that you've got, you know, a government such as the Irish government doing a sweetheart deal with an individual company to push their tax rate down to 0.005%. That is an absolute bloody joke.
Yeah.
It's got to stop.
Yeah.
It's going to have to take, you know, the G20 is happening right now in China. You got 20 of the world's largest economies together. Surely between them all, they could work something out that says we're going to stop this sort of behaviour. You know, it's going to have to come from them.
You'll never get agreement with all these groups. I think that's why you've got to just act unilaterally and say to companies like Apple, if you want to sell iPhones here, you're going to start paying tax. We don't care about your fancy money shuffling. This is what you're going to do. And but if you're relying on getting 20 countries to agree on a system, I mean, you can do all that at the same time, but, you know... Is Apple going to be around in 15 years' time, Scott? Like,
well, it will be. Yeah, it will be around. It's just in what form it will be.
You know, there's lots of companies that don't make it. Like, you know, the early, you know, Motorola BlackBerry. I mean, there's failures. Like, companies can go down. It is not inconceivable to think that the Apple of today is nothing like the Apple in 15 years' time, that if it still exists could be quite impoverished and unable to pay all the taxes that we've decided it should pay. It's quite possible.
That's a good point. That is a good point. I hadn't considered that, you know. Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Right. I get a big kick out of Mormons, Scott. I just find them hilarious. I mean, the whole notion of Joseph Smith and his hat and his seer stones, and it's just such a, you know, it's so modern and new that all of the documentation is there to say that this is just bogus nonsense.
Yep, and yet they still get them in. You know, they go knocking on people's doors, and they must do that for a reason. They must get people hooked every year.
This, you know, as that great meme said, you know, this is the fan fiction that's gone out of control, and there's and there's no relationship to the earlier movies.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yes.
So, in the rugby league community, you know, a few of the Polynesians are Mormons. It's sort of relatively strong in that sector. And that was because the Mormons were quite active in Polynesia. I mean, you got to remember, if you wanted, you know, if there was a Mormon with a good-looking wife and you really wanted to get rid of him for a while so you could, you know, have his wife join your little harem, Polynesia was an excellent place to send him. It takes a long time for him to come back, and you can have a lot of fun in the meantime. So they went quite hard in Polynesia, and they even claim that some of the early, like, you know, there's this weird early Hebrews made their way to America, and yeah, there was the different Indian tribes, and there were battles. Well, an offshoot of them supposedly made its way to Polynesia is part of the Mormon theory. So, Polynesian community, Mormons, relatively strong. Rugby league players, or rugby league, strong Polynesian element. And Will Hopewate is a rugby league player with the NRL club Canterbury Bulldogs. And he is a very full-on strong Mormon, and he, in fact, quit the game for a year or two to do his,
his worth of going around the world.
Missionary work. So he quit rugby league, but he, at the end of that, signed up with the Bulldogs, but as part of his contract, had a special condition that he could not play on Sundays because, according to his faith, he couldn't do it on a Sunday. And that's part of his contract. And on the odd occasion that the Bulldogs have played on a Sunday, John Hapawada has been missing, and they've got a big match coming up this Sunday, Scott. And he won't be there because he'll be sitting on the sidelines. Maybe he won't even be there on the sidelines. I'm not even sure if he's allowed to go that far. Missing the game due to his Mormon faith, Scott.
Well, as long as his faith sustains him, I'm sure his teammate won't be missing him.
Yeah. Well, the article I've linked to, this guy Andrew Webster says, this is crazy. And what he's saying isn't so much that Will Hopewate is crazy for taking Sundays off. He's saying that the Canterbury Bulldogs were crazy for signing him under a contract which would allow him to do that. And that they should have just said no, because, you know, you need players on a Sunday. And for goodness sake, Scott, if a team makes the grand final, guess what day of the week it will be played?
It's played on a Sunday.
Yeah. Apparently, yeah, if that's the case, if they make the grand final, then Hopewate and the Bulldogs will have a discussion about whether Hopewate will play. So he's convinced religiously that he cannot play football on Sundays. But if they make the grand final, there could be an exception. Don't know how he would justify that, yeah, theologically. I can't imagine the Book of Mormon had a specific clause about grand finals are okay.
I can't imagine they did either, but, you know, clearly that the modern Mormon can find an out for anything, so they must have an out there somewhere, so if the grand finals are okay.
Be interesting to see what he comes up with on that one. Scott, Saudi Arabia, already on our list of places never to go to. It's on my list of places never to fly over, just in case the plane has to make an emergency landing. There was a chap who was an atheist, and he did 600 tweets denying the existence of God. He ridiculed some Quranic verses, accused the prophets of lies, and said that their teachings fueled hostilities. He's been fined £4,000, but worst of all, sentenced to 10 years in prison and 2,000 lashes. Just savages, Scott.
They are savages. It really, you know... And yet I keep bringing this up. I know that the listeners are going to be sick of me saying it. They are on the UN body that looks after human rights.
Yep.
And that's the way they behave.
Just a grown-up ISIS. Just you have to think of them as a grown-up ISIS, and that explains Saudi Arabia to a T, well, I reckon.
It is crazy that they conduct themselves the way they are. And I think you're right. They are a grown-up ISIS because you've got this... ridiculous situation of Wahhabism being exported around the globe, and for what? You know, it's maddening, really. It really is maddening.
It is maddening. I mean, you know, you can have a bit of fun with the Christians about Mother Teresa, but when you start, you know, lashing somebody 2,000 times, like, that gets serious then. Like, oh, it's just a nasty streak through that religion.
Yeah, it is. It is very nasty. And, you know, when you've got the regressive left calling you a racist and that sort of stuff for pointing that out, well, you know, let's talk about marriage equality if this was a majority Muslim country. It wouldn't happen.
There was a nice picture in one of the articles I saw, Saudi Arabia. Like, women aren't allowed to drive cars in Saudi Arabia. And the picture was from the cockpit of a Royal Brunei jet. Commercial, you know, jet that was landing, and all of the flight crew were female.
Really?
Yeah, so it's interesting. An all-female flight crew from Royal Brunei landed in Saudi Arabia, the country where if they had to walk outside the airport, they wouldn't be able to drive a car.
Yeah, madness, isn't it? It really is madness.
Scott, you know, this week we're a little bit short on news articles, so I thought that I would... I mean, we've grown up Christians, so we're quite familiar, and being in our culture, we're quite familiar with Christian Bible stories, you know, that we've just come across through our... either through formal teaching at school or just osmosis through popular culture, movies or whatever. But there's lots of the Islamic faith that many people would not know anything about. And I thought this is an opportune time. I have been finished reading a book called Muhammad and the Unbelievers, The Seerah, a Political Biography by a guy called Bill Warner. And Bill Warner, American guy, says that Islam is basically defined by the words of Allah in the Quran and the words and actions of Muhammad in the Sunnah, S-U-N-N-A. And the Sunnah of Muhammad is found in two texts. You've got the Seerah, which is his biography, and you've got the Hadith, which traditions or stories about what Muhammad did or said. So this particular book I've got is the Seerah, which is his biography, talks about his life. And so essentially, we're, in terms of Islamic faith, it's not all about the Quran. It is as much about the Sunnah as it is about the Quran, because Muhammad was the perfect version of what it means to be a Muslim, and everything he did was perfect. So so what this guy says is, when you're wanting to argue about what do Muslims believe in, it's actually much easier to talk about the Sunnah being either the biography of Muhammad in the Seerah, or the Hadith being the stories about and traditions about what he did, as being much easier way of explaining what Muslims believe in. So that's sort of point A of, or the introduction, if you like. And so it's actually... like this Seerah, this biography, is 20 times as long as the Gospel of Matthew. So we know a lot more about Muhammad than we do about Jesus. There's a lot of stuff in there. a few other introductory bits is that if you were to just pick up an English version of, well, there's two sources or two biographies. The most respected sources are one by Ishaq and one by Al-Tabari. And basically, they're hard to read documents because there's just a lot of guff in there. So what he's done is he's taken out the poetry and he's taken out, like, there'll be certain pages, Scott, where just giving, it'll just be lists of names that go on for pages and pages, and just throughout the text, one person's name could be six lines long, and he just shortens it to just, you know, a shortened version of that. Lots of poetry, lots of stuff that you don't need. So he's sort of condensed it all down into a much more readable format. But if anybody wants to question any of what he's said, he's got references to the original work of Ishaq or of Al-Tabari. So as I'm reading some of this stuff, Scott, I could say, I might give one of these stories that Muhammad was raised by Abu Talib, his uncle, and I could say, well, that's Ishaq, page 115. And then people could actually look at Ishaq, page 115, and say whether it does say that or not. So, well referenced. And so when you, if you do end up, dear listener, getting a copy of this book, you can make statements about Muhammad and say, well, it says so in Ishaq, page blah, blah, blah. So I like that side of it. So I'm just going to have a bit of a crack here, Scott, and feel free to interrupt at any point.
Okay.
At just a little background of Muhammad, and to give people a bit of an idea of who he was. So, he was still in his mother's womb when his father died, and when he was five, his mother died. He was orphaned for the third time when his grandfather died. So then he was looked after by his uncle, Abu Talib. I mean, this goes to show in that day and age, Scott, people were dying left, right and centre.
Yeah.
It was a very tribal society at the time, and he was from a tribe of the Quraysh, Q-U-R-A-Y-S-H, which were kind of like the priestly tribe of Mecca. So that was the sort of tribe that he was associated with. And he ended up, he was hired by his distant cousin, the wealthy widow Khadija, to act as her trading agent. And she proposed marriage to him.
Really?
Hmm. They had six children. Two sons died in childhood. Four daughters lived to adulthood. I think only one of them survived to provide any children. But hold back on that thought. Just not quite sure on that one. But six children, two sons died in childhood, four daughters lived to adulthood. So his employer, a wealthy widow, actually proposed to him. So he leads a pretty ordinary life until the age of 40, when he began to have visions and to hear voices. That was when he started. Like, it's very late in life, particularly for somebody, you know, as we know, people are dying left, right and centre there, and, you know, 40's getting on.
It was getting on. It makes me wonder if it was if the visions and that sort of stuff were some sort of early psychosis that was set in.
Early dementia, maybe.
Yeah, early dementia, yeah.
Mm. He hated poets and the insane, and he was really upset because he thought he was becoming insane or something like that. And he went to sort of kill himself, but got more visions saying, don't kill yourself. And he went back to his wife, and he told her he was either crazy or a poet. And she said that he was neither of those things, and perhaps the vision was true. So she was the first convert, and he's getting visions from the angel Gabriel, and telling him about prayer and stuff like that. And he, you know, becomes revealed to him that he starts his new religion, which he calls Islam, which means submission. And he gets just a handful of followers. He's in Mecca at this time, and hanging around. Now, a few episodes ago, the 12th man talked about the Kaaba, which was that black, that stone sort of building that they all walk around and.
For the Hajj, yeah.
Yes, so that was, you know, there at that time, and it was a central place for Muhammad. He spent a lot of time around that. He's, you know, he's quite the orator, and he speaks quite good poetry, and he's obviously filled with a zeal and is convincing and persuasive, but also just plain crazy. This is from Ishaq, page 183. Muhammad continued to preach the glory of Allah and condemn the Quraysh religion, which was his original tribal sort of religion. He told them their way of life was stupid and insulted their ancestors, cursed their gods, mocked their religion, and divided the community, setting one tribesman against another. The Quraysh felt that this was all beyond bearing. Tolerance had always been their way. Many clans, many gods, many religions. Another religion was fine. Why did Muhammad demean the others? Now, this is in Muhammad's own biography at page 183 of Ishaq.
Yeah.
There's various other passages that I can't read, but there's a very strong theme where when he's originally just proclaiming his new religion, people are like, okay, believe what you like. Like, there's heaps of religions here. That's fine. But he had to go insulting and demonising the other ones, and that's when they had a problem.
Mm.
Gathers a few more followers, let me just...
It's a pity they didn't rub him out early on, isn't it?
It is a real pity. It is indeed. At one point, some of his followers went to Ethiopia, and some Christians from Ethiopia came back to Mecca to try and, you know, find out who this Muhammad guy was that these guys were talking about. So again, Ishaq, page 259. Some Christians came from Ethiopia to see Muhammad in Mecca. After extended conversations, they decided to accept Islam. Abu Jahl of the Quraysh said to them, quote, "What a wretched group you are. Your people sent you here to get information. And what do? You go and renounce your religion and believe everything Muhammad tells you? What a stupid bunch you are." They gave him a pleasant reply and they went back to Ethiopia. This is from the biography of, the official biography of Muhammad. Page 259. Like, well said. Well said. Okay, but... the good story that I'll spend a bit of time with before we finish up was the night journey. Scott, you might have heard a little bit about this. Starts at Ishaq, page 264. Basically, Muhammad said that one night as he lay sleeping, an angel nudged him with his foot. He awoke, saw nothing, went back to sleep. This happened again, blah, blah. Eventually, Gabriel took his arm. They went out the door, and before them, Scott, was a white animal, half mule and half donkey, with wings on its feet so it could move to the horizon at one step. So...
Okay, yep.
I've got an issue already, Scott. Forget about, having wings. A half mule and half donkey. Now, Scott, a mule... is a cross between a donkey
and a horse,
and yeah. It's sterile.
Yeah.
So you can't cross a mule then with a donkey. So I reckon, you know, this book is wrong in the first place because, well, being half mule really meant it was one quarter. I reckon it was three-quarter donkey and one-quarter horse with wings, if it was anything. Because if a mule is half donkey and half horse, then this white animal, which was half mule and half donkey, had to be three-quarter donkey and one-quarter horse. That would have been a far better explanation.
One little explanation you are overlooking here, and that is that he was psychotic at the time and was imagining this.
There is that too. But, you know, it's important that we explore all possibilities here. So, anyway, this white animal had wings. So Gabriel put Muhammad on the white animal and off they went to Jerusalem, the site of the temple. And guess who was at Jerusalem, Scott?
No idea.
We're up to Ishaq, page 264 here. There at the temple was Jesus, Abraham, Moses, and various prophets from Christian and Jewish scripture. And they decided to have a prayer. Guess, you know, you've got Jesus, Abraham, Moses, Gabriel and Muhammad. Guess who led them in the prayer?
Muhammad did.
Oh, Scott, well done. It's funny that in Muhammad's biography that he describes that he led them in prayer.
So hang on a minute. He was in Mecca when this was happening?
Oh, no, he's travelled from Mecca on the half-mule, half-donkey almost instantaneously
to Jerusalem.
Yeah, right, because this flying creature can just travel almost immediately. So it's nighttime, but he's made this incredible journey in a matter of just moments.
Right.
So he's made it to Jerusalem. He's met up with Jesus, Abraham, Moses, and prophets, and he's kicked off where he's led them in prayer. Gabriel brought Muhammad two bowls, one filled with wine and the other with milk. Muhammad took the one with milk and drank it. That was the right choice. So, next paragraph, or next page, 265 in Ishaq's biography, when Muhammad told this story at the Kaaba, the Quraysh hooted at the absurdity of it, and some of the Muslims found it too hard to believe and left Islam. Back in the 700s, there were Muslims smart enough to say, what a load of nonsense, and walked out of him at that point.
It's just a real pity that not all of them said, this is garbage, I'm out. Yeah.
But the story doesn't end there, Scott. So they're there, they finish the prayers, and Muhammad reports that Abraham looks exactly like Muhammad. Ruddy-faced, tall and thin with curly hair, whereas Jesus was light-skinned with reddish complexion, freckles and lank hair. After the prayers, Gabriel gets a very nice ladder. Muhammad and Gabriel climb the ladder until they reach the gates of heaven. So when they're there, they first of all go through various levels of heaven. So at the lowest level was a man watching the spirits pass by, sometimes approving, sometimes disapproving. This was Adam. He was reviewing the spirits. Ishaq, page 269. Muhammad saw men with lips like camels. In their hands were flaming hot coals. They would shove the coals into their mouths and the burning coals came out of their rectums. These were those who had stolen the wealth of orphans. Then he saw women hanging by their breasts. These women had birthed bastards while married. Muhammad said, Allah hates women who birth bastards. So, I mean, that's the first level of heaven. Muhammad was then taken up to the second level, where he saw Jesus. In the third level, he saw Joseph, son of Jacob. In the fourth, he saw Idris. In the sixth, a dark man with a hooked nose. This was Moses. And in the seventh heaven was a man sitting on a throne in front of a mansion. This man on the throne looked just like Muhammad, but was in fact Abraham. Abraham took Muhammad into paradise, where there was a beautiful woman with red lips. Muhammad asked to whom she belonged, for she was very attractive to him. She was Zainab, the wife of his adopted son, Zaid. You've got to hand it to Muhammad. I mean, he's hopped on a winged beast, gone all the way to Jerusalem, led the great prophets in prayer, climbed a ladder. He's gone through six stages of heaven. He gets to the seventh heaven, sees a good-looking girl and says, well, who's that? Like, I'm quite keen on her. Like, he's got an eye for the girls all the time.
He does have an eye for the girls all the time, you know. Mm. It's there was no mention of a dozen virgins, though.
No, not in this section. Will be in, you know, perhaps that's in the Quran. That wasn't really referred to in his biography. So it might be in the Quran or in the Hadith, in this. Yeah. So we're coming to the conclusion of it here. But when he got to the seventh heaven, I've heard that expression seventh heaven before, but I never thought about it. It must be referring to the seventh heaven of Muhammad. You've heard of seventh heaven, have you?
Yeah, I've heard of seventh heaven, but it was only ever, it was always around the Christian tradition, saying that the seventh heaven, that sort of stuff, but I couldn't tell you what it meant.
Yeah, okay. So he gets there. He gets to seventh heaven, and Allah gave him the duty of 50 prayers a day, Scott. So Allah said, you and your followers need to do 50 prayers a day.
50 a day?
Yes. Now, when he returned...
What they do, is it the four or five prayers they do a day?
Well, here's the explanation, Scott.
Okay.
So Allah says to Muhammad, right, Muhammad, you and your followers, if you want to be good Muslims, you need to do 50 prayers a day. So... when he returned and he passed Moses, so that would be back in sixth heaven, Moses asked Muhammad how many prayers Allah had given him. When Moses heard that it was 50, he said, prayer is a weighty matter and your people are weak. Go back and ask your Lord to reduce the number for you and your community. Muhammad went back and got the number reduced to 40. When he passed Moses, the same conversation passed. This repeated until Allah reduced the number to 5. Moses tried to get Muhammad to go back and get the number reduced even further, but Muhammad felt ashamed to ask for less. Oh, he's haggled. Muhammad, on behalf of his people, has haggled the number of prayers to say per day on the advice of...
from 50 down to 5.
On the advice of Moses. This is in Ishaq, page 271, dear listener. So, it's incredible, isn't it?
Well, you know what I find incredible about this, though, is that, you know, you and I are coming at this completely stone cold, knowing nothing about it.
Mm.
So we can sit here and say, this is ridiculous.
Mm.
I just wonder, you know, are kids raised with this all their lives so that they've got no choice but to believe it? Or, you know, how does their cynical mind, not their cynical mind, but how does their, what's the word I'm groping for? You know what I'm trying to say, don't you?
How do they apply critical thinking to it? Or is
exactly.
Well, when you're brainwashed. Like, I've got all the sympathy in the world for the kids who are brainwashed, and it's... and the adults who were brainwashed as kids, I'm really unsympathetic for the likes of, I think Walid Ali's wife was a late convert to Islam. Like, she converted at 19 or 20 or something. And I just think,
yeah,
for goodness sake, you were an adult. Did you, if you are a follower of Islam, you have to believe all this garbage. I mean,
exactly.
Muhammad was the perfect... he was perfection. that we haven't even begun, Scott, on the warlike atrocities that he then commits onto the non-believers in Mecca and Medina, and what goes on there. But, you know, if your religion is based around this guy, you've only got to scratch the surface of his own biography to go, this is completely bonkers.
Yeah.
As an educated Western person, that you could, for an instant... I mean, 700 years ago, the Quraysh tribe were saying to the Ethiopians, what sort of people are you? You've been sent here to investigate and you've swallowed everything you've said, you stupid idiots. Like,
yeah, exactly.
So, it's frustrating. So, but anyway, I thought that's interesting. So in the coming weeks, we'll, dear listener, help you with a little ride along the life of Muhammad. And I mean, it starts off comical, but it gets pretty darn ugly as
very
we go
quickly
along.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right, Scott, we've come to the end of episode 61. Thank you, dear listeners.
Thank you very much, listeners.
Yep. We shall return next week, maybe with 100 likes. A quick disclaimer. You know, we're members of the Secular Party. Views expressed here, not necessarily views of the Secular Party. Check out the website and join. That would be great, because there's going to be an election in less than 3 years. Well, less than that, most probably. And feel free to help us out in any way that you can. We need volunteers on our Facebook page as editors, doing infographics, helping with press releases. Any stuff, if you've got a little skill and you think you've got an hour or two a week or a fortnight and you could contribute, that would be very handy. So
absolutely, yeah.
All right, Scott, until next week.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you again next week. Bye now.
Bye, everyone. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is, you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.